You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on news that made headlines this past week. Today, our panelist includes Heath Druzan with Boise State Public Radio, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Nate Eaton is joining us from East Idaho News right now. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Nate, I want to start with you. You spoke with us a little bit earlier this week. You are basically, you are the reporter, you are the news outlet that really broke the story of Lori Vailo and Chad Daybell and the case of Lori's two missing children, JJ and Tylee. Can you take us back to Tuesday morning and what happened and where we are as of today with this investigation?
Tuesday morning, we learned that the Fremont County Sheriff's Office showed up to Chad Daybell's house around 7 o'clock with a search warrant. They had been to this home before back in January, and they seized a couple dozen electronic devices and journals and things like that. So this warrant was not too unexpected. But it was interesting because this specific warrant was to cover his property and was to cover excavation and things like that. We went out to the home immediately, and this was also different in the fact that the blocks around the home were closed by police. They had shut down any access to the home, and we decided that we would try to get a helicopter and go up in the air over the house. So we got a chopper, and we flew over the home, and I immediately noticed that there were some blue canopies and some blue tarps, and they were looking like they would be digging into the ground. And sure enough, that did happen. Within a few hours, a bulldozer was brought in, and Chad Daybell was placed into custody. They did not say originally what he was arrested for, but this was the first time that it looked like he would be facing some criminal charges since all of this story broke out late last year. And then by mid-afternoon, the police confirmed that human remains were found in Chad Daybell's backyard on the property. And he was charged with two counts of destruction or concealment of evidence. And they later confirmed that two sets of children's remains were found on the property. Family members tell us that they are the remains of Tylee Ryan and JJ Vailo, the two kids who have been missing since September.
And then Chad had a court appearance then on Wednesday, and Bell was set fairly high, especially for the charges that he's facing right now, Nate.
Yeah, he appeared in court wearing a white and gray black striped gel jumpsuit uniform. It was done via Zoom because of the pandemic. So the judge was in one box and the prosecutor was in another, and Chad and his attorney were in the third. And you know, these charges, the maximum penalty you can get for each charge is 5 years in prison. And so they're serious charges, but there are obviously much more serious charges. And his attorney made that argument that why do you want to hold him on $1 million bail when these charges aren't that serious? If he's charged with more serious crimes, up the bail. But the judge did not agree with that argument and went with the prosecutor's recommendation to set bail at $1 million. It's assumed that harsher charges will be coming as early next week. They are finishing the autopsies on those two children in Boise. The prosecutor from Madison County is in Boise today as they're doing those autopsies. So it's likely that Chad Daybell will face more serious charges. It's also very possible that Lori Vailo, who's in the Madison County Jail on $1 million bond for deserting her children, allegedly, those charges could be modified to serious charges, or, you know, they now know where the children are. So it's not a question of where, but what happened to them and how did they get there. So she could face additional charges and you know, this case could take more twists and turns as it has already done over the past few months.
Nate, do you know anything more about about how they found out that the children's remains were on the property. I know when we spoke on Tuesday, you were waiting, hopefully, to get some more documentation in the arrest warrant and things like that. And at this point, all we had heard is that the prosecutor had said during Chad's hearing that quote, one of the bodies was found, I believe, was buried in an egregious way.
Yeah, he did say that. The case is sealed, so those specifics have not been released publicly. We've heard some information that we're not ready to report quite yet about the bodies, but what we do know is that it was a series of small clues, tips, follow-up things that within the past week the investigators kind of put together. They put all of these tips together from a bunch of different sources, and they came up with the information they needed to go and do that search on Tuesday. I asked the police chief Tuesday night, I said, so has this been in the works for weeks? And he looked at me as if I was crazy and said, no, this has not been in the works for weeks. And I think had they known this information months ago, they would not have waited, obviously. Mm-hmm. When they did go in the winter, it was snowy and it was cold and the ground was frozen. So maybe you couldn't do a dig at that point. But something came together within the past week and a half that led them to the property that day.
And Nate, before I let you go, there has not been official confirmation that these are the bodies of JJ and Ty Lee. However, JJ's biological grandparents, they are in Idaho now, correct? They live out of state. And they, and I believe Ty Lee's older brother, have said that they have been told that they are the children.
Yeah, the grandparents arrived the night before last, and they have reported that they are the kids, along with Tylee's aunt and brother. Yeah, so that the family has said that. The investigators from the beginning said they would not officially identify them until autopsies are performed and they can have 100% verification that it is them. So the family has ID'd them, and we would imagine that maybe today, definitely by Monday, those remains should be officially identified.
Nate, thanks for coming on. I appreciate the update and the reporting that you and your crew have been doing on this case. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Gemma.
We are going to continue on with some other developing news coming out of Boise City Hall just in the last hour. Don, can you talk to us about this? And I know this literally came down in the last hour regarding property taxes in the city of Boise for fiscal year 21.
It is so new that when we were doing an audio check with your producer, Samantha Wright, she mentioned it, and I actually hadn't even seen the news release email yet, but there is now a story up on boisedev.com. The headline, a little surprising out of the city of Boise, that Boise Mayor Lauren McClain will now propose will propose no tax increase for property taxes this year. That is surprising in two ways. One, the city of Boise, as far as my research can show, has raised taxes on property in the city, the maximum allowed percentage of 3% each of the last 16 budget years. I couldn't find records before that. That was the term of Boise Mayor Dave Beter. This year, she had initially proposed to increase property taxes 2%, which was less than normal, but still an increase. Today, the mayor's office saying, nope, we're actually going to propose no property tax increase. Now, property taxes is one of those things that as a business journalist, I cover a lot, and they're very complicated, especially in Idaho, and there's lots of factors at play. Your property tax bill isn't just dictated by what the Boise City Council or mayor decides. The legislature has a say in the way the allocation formula works. The county has a piece of this. The Mosquito Abatement District, the College of Western Idaho, and on and on. But the city of Boise is certainly a large symbol of that. And we'll just talk about narrative for a second. I think the narrative in the state is that Boise is one of the most liberal areas. And so people aren't surprised when politicians in this area raise taxes. I had asked McClain about property taxes probably two or three times during the campaign, enough that she was probably annoyed with me asking about it. And in November, I had a long sit down with her, and she told me at the time, this is in November, quote, "I think it's super easy politics to say, I promise I would freeze the tax rate, but that's not what voters want in elected officials. We need to have a more nuanced recognition that these are hard decisions that have to be made." So now here we are today, and she's saying, you know what, we are not going to propose any tax increase on property taxes in the city for the year. They're saying that there's going to be a $3.2 million hit to the budget. They don't exactly say how they're going to outline that. We'll know more at the city council meeting on Tuesday. There's a little bit more news that just dropped within the last couple seconds on this. One of the pieces that's important here is just because the mayor proposes something doesn't mean that the city council will go along with it. Right. I have heard questions from city council members that lead me to believe that they would like to see the impact of what taking a 2% versus a 3% raise would be. Council President Pro Tem Holly Woodings retweeted my story on this and said, "Thankful Boise mayor listened to city council and will propose an amended budget. We hear the struggles of Boiseans during COVID-19, including lack of unemployment compensation for so many and an unknown recession, and ask for a change of course." So that indicates that there's at least one vote on the council for the lack of a tax increase. McLean will need to get at least three more, and we'll see how this plays out Tuesday. It's been an interesting few weeks in city politics, I think it's fair to say, and this is a story that really surprised me.
So Don, with that said though, if the city council passes this and they don't do an increase, that doesn't mean that you don't get a property tax bill, as you said, No. Correct? Because
yeah, you'll get a property tax bill. Yeah. And you will get a property tax bill that probably is higher than last year because property tax values have gone up. Property values have gone up. Mm-hmm. So if you own a home that, we'll just use simple numbers, was worth $100,000 last year, one, that I don't think that exists, but
where do you live?
Yeah. I was trying to use a simple number. We'll say $250,000. That's still probably low. And that went up in value, and now it's worth $275,000. Your property taxes will still go up. But with this lack of a tax increase, they'll go up a little less. A little less than they might have otherwise. And sometimes this is symbolic, and it might have been symbolic on the other side when former Mayor Beter and the council that Lauren McLean served on took those 3% increases each year. It didn't necessarily mean a huge increase in people's taxes because it was one piece and because of the valuations, but it is symbolic. The other piece of this is the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which McLean called a fringe group a couple weeks ago on another issue, came out and said a huge win for Boise taxpayers if it holds. So City politics in Boise are surprising and changing and interesting. This goes back to the election, and I wrote a piece last summer that talked about the race between McLean and Beter, and I've talked about it on Idaho Matters. And to win, it looked to me like McLean was going to have to build a coalition of voters to Mayor Beter's left and to his right. Now, it's hard to tell from the results if that happened. Clearly, she won by a large margin. But you can imagine that there are people who were to the right and more conservative than Dave Beter that said, hey, we'll give this new person a shot. And it's interesting to see her legislate with a mandate that is maybe less typical than we usually see in city politics.
So Tuesday will be the time when we find out during the city council meeting what that potential impact, because I mean, it's $3.2 million impact to the budget, where that money.
Yeah, we'll get. Exactly. We'll get more details and more granular details, and there's more reporting to be had here. This story obviously breaking within the last hour. What does Council President Elaine Clegg think? What do the other members of the council think? We'll know more. Tuesday will be a key night, I think, for the council, and I will probably be there in person in attendance, and we'll have reporting on BoiseDev.com for you as we follow this and see what the impacts are to everyday Boiseans.
So other big news, the Governor Little held a news conference yesterday in regards to where we are phase-wise and if we would enter phase 4 in our stage reopening of Idaho. And he decided to move forward with reopening into phase 4, but saying, quote, "We almost didn't get there."
Yeah, he was pretty upfront that we kind of barely scraped by the state's metrics. And to be totally honest, I mean, I think the state's metrics have always been a little bit confusing and maybe a bit of a moving target. But he was specific in one thing. Well, I should say, actually, Dr. Christine Hahn, the state epidemiologist, was specific about one benchmark that was very concerning, and that is the number of healthcare workers who are being infected. She said if the state's decision was just based on that rate, that we would not have moved forward to stage four. So there's obviously some pretty deep concern about the trends going on right now as we push forward.
And I think we should be pretty clear here. This really seems to be politically motivated, honestly, because as we said, I mean, it seems like the metrics are kind of shifting and everything. There's a really good article in the Idaho Press that Betsy Russell wrote, if people want to look at that. I mean, Betsy had some really hard questions for the governor yesterday in regards to this, because the governor in his news conference, said Idahoans need to stop being selfish and they need to follow guidelines, saying you need to be wearing your mask, you need to be social distancing. But as he's saying this, what's going on over at the State House with our legislators?
Right. So, this was really the first time that I've heard the governor really call people out for not doing their part. And he really said, Idahoans aren't doing enough personally to wear masks, to keep their physical distance, et cetera, et cetera. And there was some real irony there. Reporter Clark Corbin with Idaho Ed News was walking through the Capitol right after Governor Little had said that. And he snapped a picture of several lawmakers who were all in a tight circle. Nobody had masks. And they were all talking to each other, not keeping a 6-foot distance. And again, with no masks. And it was kind of like, and all of them were from Little's own caucus. So you really have to wonder, if his own caucus isn't listening to him, then how effective is this message to the wider public?
And I think that on the same day that it is announced that we will go into phase four, which will happen tomorrow, which means groups of more than 50 can gather, large venues can open, the Boise downtown YMCA closed for deep cleaning. And that's because there was someone who tested positive for COVID who was in that facility. So they had to shut down. But Heath and anyone else who wants to talk about this, we then find out that there was something that happened at some Boise bars downtown over, I believe, last weekend, correct?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Dan.
Well, yeah, either one. I mean, there was. So there was what Central District Health called a cluster. They said that 5 people tested positive, and there's another 5 probable cases, meaning people who weren't tested but were in close contact with the initial 5. And the bars were Amsterdam Lounge, The Cactus, Hump and Hannah's, Silly Birch, Strange Love, and Tom Graney's. And they said that anybody there on June 5th or 6th should watch for symptoms. And I think it's really important because there's a lot of things coming out right now. If you look at the trend in the Boise area, the 7-day trend, so not individual days, which can sometimes get a little misleading, that 7-day trend, we are still well below early May and even mid-May. Now, those things could change and we could tick up, but it's hard because I think a lot of folks look at the statewide data. And while that's important on a statewide basis, I think it's also really important that people look at what's happening in their areas. The Twin Falls area has been especially hard hit. Nicole has done great reporting on that. And it's different from area to area across the state.
Right. But I think, going back to the point, though, of these clusters, what's interesting to me about this is that, just anecdotally, in my own experience, not as a journalist, just my personal experience, is I notice people of a certain age, more of them not wearing masks. They typically tend to be under the age of 30. And I've just noticed that. And so then you can, I think, make a bit of a correlation to who's going to those downtown bars, right? In the evening hours. I'm asleep at 10 o'clock. I mean,
well, and Channel 2's Channel 2's Denny Hawkins had this photo that I actually retweeted. It's from May 31st. It's of one of the bars in question, and there are lots of people packed in there very tightly. And it's, I mean, nothing stronger than a photo to tell you when things are happening. And I won't name the name of the individual bar, but you can also say, hey, which of these clubs are trying to enforce social distancing and really trying to keep people apart and which aren't?
Because we should note that Karma, a bar downtown Boise, actually closed down early because the manager said, you're not social distancing. You're not doing the things you're supposed to be doing. And we're not going to have this here. So there is that. But Heath, any word? I mean, have any of the bars said anything? I mean, has the YMCA come out with a statement that we know of about them closing down? I believe they are reopened today after cleaning.
Right. And I believe the Y, they said they're going to do basically a deep cleaning and then reopen. And I know that the head of the Y had said in the past that, you know, they were reopening, but basically reserved the right to adjust as needed. And it sounds like they have. I mean, obviously these things are going to come up, right? I mean, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. I think some people, it's easy to forget that. And I think once we started reopening, it seemed like there was a pretty big segment of the population that kind of took that to mean that we were past it. But we're obviously not. And I had an interesting back and forth actually on Twitter yesterday with Dr. Tommy Ahlquist, who is, you know, he leads the Crush the Curve campaign, which is a private effort to get more testing. And he sounded very concerned. So I just outright asked him. I said, okay, well, so should we be in stage 4 right now? And he did finally answer my question. And he said, not based on what I'm hearing on the ground. Now he said, you know, he's not the state. He said he doesn't have all of the data. But he also said, quote, all I know is we are in for a long and wild ride. And I think that's a ride that none of us particularly want to be on.
I would agree,
Gemma,
with that.
Gemma, and something else like to point out as well is that, you know, we're talking about so many of these different metrics that the state, you know, is and isn't hitting. And some of the other things that we're continuing to see, it's, you know, it's not just, you know, an outbreak at, you know, everyone flocking to the newly reopened bars. We're right. also seeing, you know, increasing rates of infection among some of Idaho's vulnerable communities that we've seen nationwide are at much higher risk from this virus for a variety of factors. But the Latino population in the Magic Valley, like Don pointed out, is, you know, it's, they're really being impacted when it comes to the rate of infection in the Southwest District Health, which has Canyon County, the largest Hispanic population in the state. Their percentage of infection rate among Hispanics and Latinos also just jumped this last 2 weeks. It's up to something like, I think, 36-37%. And also too, multiple outlets reported yesterday that we've now had our first member of Boise's homeless community test right. positive. There's a lot of other metrics that we've seen be a concern across the country that maybe Idaho was a little bit slower to get to, and there may or may not be necessarily playing into any of the state's decisions for when to reopen.
Well, and the Statesman's Audrey Dutton reported that 60% of the deaths, and Nicole, correct me if I'm wrong, that 60% of the deaths had occurred in nursing homes.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which is just eye-opening.
Well, and let's note that the Idaho Statesman had to threaten to sue the Department yeah. of Health and Welfare to get those numbers because the state was not sharing those numbers.
Yeah, and the governor often points out, we have a very diverse state in many ways, and certainly geographically, and in when it comes to race and ethnicity in some places of the state, and also just the different needs. And not everyone might be tracking at the same point as the entire state is opening.
And Nicole, where are we though in knowing, because I know you've done reporting on this, are we getting accurate information, do you believe, when it comes to our more vulnerable populations in the sense of, do we know? I mean, because we from the reporting you've been doing, I mean, we know that the Latino community in Idaho in particular is being adversely affected by this, much more so than Caucasians.
Well, it's one of those hard things where we do know for some parts of the state what it looks like. For example, in South Central Health District, which includes the Magic Valley, when we're talking about race and demographic information like that, the majority of their cases, they know the race or ethnicity of the people who have tested positive. And so that's been able to give a kind of a much clearer picture and be able to see that more than 50% of 5 of 8 counties in that district, there are of the people who have tested positive for Latino. That's a very clear picture. However, when you get into the Treasure Valley area, when you get into Canyon County, which is in South District Health, and then of course Central District Health, in both of those districts, which encompass a wide swath of Idaho's overall population in general, they don't have race or ethnicity information for 50% of those cases in each district. Mm-hmm. So we're talking at least 400 cases in, I think around 400 cases in Central District Health, which includes Ada County. And I believe about 200 cases, give or take, in Southwest District Health, which has Canyon County. And so right now, based on what we do know, based on the cases that do have race and ethnicity information, we see that Latinos in the Southwest District Health are trending, more likely to get this virus, or disproportionately at least. Mm-hmm. But we don't have all of that information for the cases. And that means that we might have a very unclear picture of something that, again, like, this is not a thing that Idaho discovered. It has been reported in every single state that Latinos and Blacks are being hit very hard by this virus. And of course, not everybody gives that demographic information, right? But if people aren't looking for that, aren't seeking that out, I don't know how we're supposed to know how these communities are being affected.
And Nicole, it's not just that the Black communities and the Latino communities are being hit harder by getting the virus, they are also dying at higher rates. As well.
Yes, and around the country, we have not yet seen that here in Idaho. Right now, that's so far. I think we're at about 4 or 5 of our state's coronavirus deaths were Hispanic or Latino, and similarly proportionate what you would expect for our Black and Asian populations. So right now, Idaho's not following that trend. But again, we're kind of a month behind everyone else, and we just don't know everything that we know right now.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the nursing facilities, we had Audrey Dutton on the show earlier this week to talk about this, because she did in her reporting say that there are at least 2 nursing facilities in the state that have outbreaks currently going on in their facilities. And as we move into phase 4, part of phase 4 is allowing visitors back into nursing facilities.
Yeah, it's certainly an issue. And it's one of those things where there's been, there are of course many people who are pushing and eager to, reopen as quickly as possible. But we also have every reporter on the show today has heard concerns from people tied to maybe a specific data point, asking why is the state reopening when this is happening in nursing homes, when this is happening in the Latino community, when we have a significant number of cases tied to bars in downtown. A lot of people are, I think, confused.
Right. And questioning how this is working. So Heath, one thing that you have reported on, and I'm very curious about this. Here we are in the midst of a pandemic around our country. Then we have protests continuing to go on regarding police brutality, systemic racism in our country. And yet armed militia are seeing all of this as an opportunity.
Yeah, right. There's 2020 is a lot, isn't it?
It's so much.
Yes. Right.
It's just so much. And it's like 5 years in one.
I know. I've started referring to the weeks as month weeks.
The decade of 2020.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, I mean, what's happening is obviously everybody can see that the pandemic has caused a lot of economic devastation, and now we certainly have unrest around the country as people protest against police brutality and racism. And what's been happening kind of on the fringes of that is that a lot of groups like militias and sort of so-called sovereign citizen movements, people who are very skeptical of the government, they have seen an increased interest in their movements by people who are seeing, you know, it's ironic because people are actually seeing both the absence of government in some places and, you know, some chaos, and also heavy-handed government tactics where they're seeing the government, you know, really come down hard on peaceful protesters. And both of those things, as well as a lot of economic uncertainty, a lot of experts are telling me that it is pushing more people to groups that a lot of people see as sort of fringe anti-government groups. And that was confirmed by Eric Parker to me, and he's the leader of the Real 3%ers of Idaho. And you might know him from some the original Bundy standoff down in Nevada.
Okay.
Yeah, he was saying he's seen an increased interest in his group, and he was saying a lot more sort of middle of the road Idahoans have been coming to his group to talk about self-reliance, to talk about you know, a lot of them have maybe bought weapons for the first time, and they're just asking for some training on how to safely handle their weapons. And this has alarmed a lot of people who see these groups as dangerous. Now, of course, Eric Parker does not see his group as that. He says they're a community organization. And they certainly have done some things like being involved in these potato giveaways. And these things are kind of a softer side of the militia movement. And that in and of itself worries some people who see it as mainstreaming groups that they see as potentially a problem.
So are they actively recruiting, or is it that people are seeking them out, Heath?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both, and it's also a little difficult to know where the line is, because a lot of this recruiting or sort of advertising is more really what it is online. So you got Facebook pages, you've got memes, right? You've got these groups sort of highlighting what's happening and highlighting the chaos and basically making a nod to how they might respond. So it really is a little bit of both. And it's hard to know where that line is, because it's not like these groups have sort of open books, right? You can't really get into the background of what they're doing, other than to see their public face, which again is on social media. But certainly there's a group called, I'm blanking the exact name, but I believe it's the Big Igloo Boys. And it's basically a group that is promoting being prepared for what they see as the second civil war in America, or what they call the Boogaloo or the Big Igloo. Oh. Yeah, there's so many terms. But you know, this group has 35,000 followers, and they have gained more than 4,000 in just about 2 weeks. And now that's not a perfect way to track these things. Obviously there's a low bar to entry for following a Facebook page, but it's significant numbers.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then Don, I mean, Heath mentioned this, you know, part of this being economic uncertainty, right? But what are you seeing? Because you just held a really big event about, how Idaho businesses are faring.
I'm seeing a lot of bullishness on in the startup space, and we did an event yesterday with the Idaho Tech Council that featured a really interesting mix of folks. It had Albertsons, it had the local venture capital firm Stage.io, it had a business called Tackle.io that does stuff in the cloud, it had Crave Delivery, which is a new local delivery service for food. And then a defense contractor that helps deactivate drones called Black Sage. And what's interesting is they're all trying to adjust for the pandemic, but Tackle, the cloud-based company here, just got a significant round of funding and is looking to grow. And more broadly than that, I think there are a lot of businesses that are not in what you would consider those hard-hit sectors like hospitality and restaurants and retail that are actually operating pretty well right now. And it's an interesting element in our economy, I think, as you have some businesses that it's like nothing happened and some businesses that are so hard hit that there's uncertainty. I talked to a small downtown Boise business owner this week who had a PPP loan and the money's run out, and their profits and their revenue aren't nearly where they were pre-pandemic or even a year ago, and they're weighing whether they have to lay those employees off again. So the economic story is very complicated, and it's not just an unemployment number you can look at. It's not just a company raising money you can look at. There's a lot to it, and it's very nuanced, and it's a lot to report on, that's for sure.
Well, and Don, you've reported in the past, but then not only do you have like companies that are maybe potentially going under or companies not doing as well, but then you have companies like Albertsons that are having unprecedented growth because of
that. We've talked about Albertsons' success here on this program before, and they are having unprecedented growth. They are still looking to do their IPO. They took a $1.7 billion investment from a large venture capital firm. And Andy Scoggin, who just left the company but is now consulting with them, he was a senior vice president. He appeared on this program yesterday with me, and he talked about what that investment does. It gives them a valuation that's firm of about $10 billion. It allows Wall Street to be able to say, oh, hey, look, this large player invested at this rate, and may help them get to that initial public offering on the stock market. So again, there's an employer that they've added. What was it, Gemma? Do you remember, like 50,000 employees across the country in 2 months? I can't remember what the number was. It was a big number. I mean,
it was a huge number. And one of the things they did too, remember, is they took like employees from Regal Cinemas and employed them all in their stores. I mean, so they've re-employed other people. But right, the numbers are phenomenal. Right, when you look at on how many people they had to hire.
Well, and I always talk about how much under the radar it is that Boise is such a big community for the grocery industry, because not only do we have Albertsons, but we have Winco, which is a significant and growing player. And then you have a lot of businesses that service those accounts, Procter & Gamble and Sara Lee and General Mills. They all have offices and people here because they need to be in close proximity to those grocers. And grocery is a sector that is really doing well right now. So I think the economic picture in Idaho is complicated. I talked one more thing on this. I talked to Peter Oliver, who is a principal at TOK, which is a commercial real estate firm here in town, for a story I'm working on next week. And he said, you know, if you're going to go get surgery, you want to be as healthy as you can before that surgery. We just went through major surgery. But before this happened, the Boise economy and the health of this area was very strong. Mm-hmm. And that hopefully will help us on the other side. And that is an interesting perspective. So what will happen in weeks and months to come, you know, at Boise Dev, we try not to predict. But it's going to be a story to follow as we all try and figure out how these things work together. And you add in the housing market and all those things, property taxes that we talked about. There's a lot to it.
Nicole, you literally just published a story before you came on air with us today. This is in regards to what we're seeing nationally with being a huge cry for Confederate monuments to be taken down. Notably, a lot of these are in the South. I mean, I there was a monument of Robert E. Lee that came down in Richmond, Virginia, just recently. But this has been something that there has been a cry for this for many years, and now something seems to be coming of it. But for many people, they might not realize that there are Confederate, I don't know if you would call them monuments, but there are Confederate images in Idaho.
And names too. It's a fun thing to discover this thousands of miles away from any Civil War battle ever took place. Right. It's Yes. So to just today, if you drive by the Cathedral of the Rockies in Boise, you know, a very iconic church in our state, you might notice a huge banner outside. And that's very similar to one that is inside that says in big letters, "We repent." The church just in the last 2 days announced that it was going to be planning to remove and likely replace a stained glass window that includes an image of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. And something that's kind of interesting about it, you can see photos and a video of it on the Idaho Statesman.com, but I'll tell you who he's standing with that some people might be a little shocked by. He's standing in a panel with Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. And so for, you know, of course, there were calls to remove this window before this week, or make changes or do something to acknowledge that, you know, this was something that many in the community felt was very hurtful. But it didn't really have any success until this week.
Right, because this came up, in 2017 after that mm-hmm. white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. And nothing was done.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Church leaders were saying, though, that it kind of, you know, some people knew about it in the community, but not a lot of people. I don't know if any of you guys knew about it.
I had no idea. No, I didn't know.
Yeah. It was kind of an internal church discussion that they've been having in these several years, especially as they're, you know, as we've seen in recent years, just even more and more, you know, Confederate imagery and, you know, being associated with some pretty, pretty horrible, violent acts in the name of white supremacy. And, that's something that the church has decided to replace and remove. They were originally going to put a plaque and say, "We acknowledge that this is an issue," but they've decided that they're going to replace it. But it's been there for 60 years. It was these stained glass windows at the Cathedral of the Rockies were built in 1960.
So any ideas as to what they will replace it with, or who they would replace it with?
Well, they're kind of trying to figure out what to do. A couple of people that have been tossed out as examples is, you know, Harriet Tubman, since many of the windows in the church don't just contain Bible stories, but important figures in American mm-hmm. history. They're not settled on that quite yet, but it is one of those things that they really want to address now, because they actually discovered in church documents that this window was purposely included by the then pastor of the church as kind of the way the current pastor described it, is what they were able to find from the notes, was as a nod and, you know, an inclusive and reconciliatory gestures towards the Southern transplants who were in Boise. And of
course,
the
white
that was
Southern transplants.
Yes, only white Southern transplants. And of course, it's just another example of, you know, Boise has a Confederate influence in history that we may not be aware of, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It was in a church in downtown, probably one that many people have walked by. And many people don't think, and the church certainly doesn't think that it has a place in that church anymore.
Oh, we are out of time. I want to thank all of you for coming in today, taking the whole hour with us. There was a lot to get to. So thank you to our journalist, Nicole Foy with Idaho Statesman, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Heath Rusin with Boise State Public Radio. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
And on Monday, we are going to be having a conversation with national experts about how to talk to our children about race and systemic racism in our country. We are looking for your questions. We really want you to be a part of the conversation. We want your children to be a part of the conversation, too. You can send us a voice memo. Just do it on your smartphone and then email it to idahomatters@boisestate.edu, or send us an email as well. Would really love to hear from you about that conversation. It's Friday. I hope you can find some joy in the weekend. And of course, we will see you back here on Monday.